Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, are college campuses still committed to a core principle of American identity, the freedom of speech? And how well do the students and faculty understand what that means, especially what students think because they're sometimes the formal and often the informal gatekeepers of free speech on campus? Condoleezza Rice found that out when she decided against speaking at Rutgers after students protested the invitation to her. At Howard University, former FBI Director James Comey was shouted down and heckled. And at Middlebury College, protesters demonstrated against American Enterprise Institute scholar Charles Murray, the author of The Bell Curve. Numerous professors, including one of our guests today, have also experienced serious backlash from so-called watch groups for opinions that they've expressed in the media. So as our Friday roundtable discussion begins, I'd like to hear from you, especially if you're currently a student or you've just graduated, or if you work on a college campus. Now, think about this. How willing, and I mean truly willing, are you to hear and give critical thought to speech or an opinion that doesn't agree with your own? Why is there such open intolerance to oppositional arguments and views? You can tweet me on this on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Danielle Allen is a professor of government at Harvard and the author of a number of books, including Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Peter Berkowitz is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and the author of Constitutional Conservatism. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Danielle and Peter were in town for a discussion on academic freedom at St. Olaf earlier this week. And Brian Rosenberg is the president of McAllister College. Welcome. Good to have you back, Brian. Thank
you. Happy to be here.
Danielle, I think it would be instructive to begin with your own experience, and that is in February of 2016, months before Donald Trump was elected, you wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post that urged Republicans to stop Trump's candidacy. And I think I'm going to quote from the op-ed because I think it's important to hear in your own words how you framed it. Like any number of us raised in the late 20th century, I have spent my life perplexed about exactly how Hitler could have come to power in Germany. Watching Donald Trump's rise, I now understand. Leave aside whether a direct comparison of Trump to Hitler is accurate. That is not my point, again, in your words. My point, rather, is about how a demagogic opportunist can exploit a divided country. What else do you want to say about the piece before we talk about the reaction, Danielle?
Well, I mean, the piece does focus on the division in the country, the division in the Republican Party, and what sort of political opportunities that made possible. I think if you take a big comparative view of the ways in which outsider populists have risen to power in countries across the globe, you will find that that kind of social division and partisan division is a common feature. In fact, there's a book coming out this spring by Dan Ziblatt and Steve Levitsky called How Democracies Die, which lays out a whole lot of cases around the world. So it's true that I reached for the German case as one that was most present to mind. But what I was interested in there was the story of the German people rather than of a particular person.
The reaction focused on the comparison that you made, right? And what happened?
Well, I mean, there was a concentrated Twitter campaign against me full of, really quite vicious forms of attacks and threatening kinds of attacks. I had a friend do a social network analysis of it for me. One of the surprising features of it actually was how many of the people who had tweeted threatening things at me were based in Europe. So it was an interesting moment of discovering the way in which there was coordination in the effort to both, in some sense, support some parts of the Trump campaign and also to silence people who were seeking to raise questions about the caliber of the campaign and where we were all headed.
Did you at any point think that comparison that I made in the first paragraph, basically, of the op-ed? Well, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. What did you think after seeing the reaction pointed at the comparison that you made?
Well, I continued to think about the question.
Okay.
I mean, the fact of the matter is I told the truth in the sense that I have spent my life perplexed about how Germany, which had a strong liberal tradition, could have seen a dramatic turn in its own politics. I believed we were watching a dramatic turn in our own politics. And for the first time in my life, I understood that internal division within the population and internal division within parties is what permits those kinds of dramatic turns. That's the truth I told.
So, Peter, to that truth, as Danielle sees it, and not what happened in the aftermath, which we'll talk about as well, what would you say about the argument?
My view is that while there are serious concerns, the election of Donald Trump shows that there have been changes in our politics. It reflects a divided America, an angry America, a majority, by the way, who, I should say, many supporters among Donald Trump who are angry not only at the Democratic establishment, but also at the Republican establishment. It's populist anger. It still seems to me that the comparison is overblown. There was, I didn't detect in the Trump campaign, notwithstanding occasional extraordinary tweets, a menace to the fundamental rights that the country is devoted to or to the democratic order. Whereas in the case of the fascist dictators of Europe, they were explicitly about overthrowing a liberal and democratic orders.
So as a conservative, we're hearing you respond to the essence of the argument that Danielle was making.
No, as a student of politics, okay. Not necessarily as a man of the right or the left.
Fair enough. Can I ask you this? Did you feel that the argument that she was making in the forum that she was making it was in some ways outside the bounds of political argument?
Of course not.
You should explain why you say that so quickly.
Well, I should. And thank you for the opportunity. Because consistent, I believe, with the best of the American tradition, I have an expansive understanding of what political argument includes. And political argument includes just about everything. There's some narrow exceptions we can talk about. And it's certainly the bounds of acceptable discourse certainly don't end with opinions with which I disagree. It's a perfectly respectable opinion in the public discourse. Not a day goes by where there's some opinion on the Washington Post editorial page which I don't disagree. That's one of the purposes for the Washington Post editorial page, to give me a range of opinions and to give me an opportunity to, by the way, thinking about Danielle's op-ed gives me an opportunity to refine my own understanding of who Donald Trump is, what the phenomenon he represents, what it is like and what it's not like.
So, Brian, aren't we in the reaction that Danielle got and in some of these other incidences that we're going to talk about, suggesting or seeing a culture that says almost everything is not within the bounds of political argument, as Peter is saying, and that people are intolerant of hearing opinions and positions with which they don't agree?
I think it's inescapable that that is more strongly the case now than it was 10 or 20 years ago.
What happened?
I am a strong believer in the negative impact of social media on the quality of our public discourse. I think we live in an age of shaming, and I think social media has contributed powerfully to that. I think we're still in the process of figuring out exactly how some of these tools, Facebook, Twitter, have affected our culture. I think our technological understanding has gotten well ahead of our ethical and philosophical and political understanding. And so I think whether it's deliberately disruptive forces from Eastern Europe or just people within our own country who use these tools in ways to shut down discourse, I think it's one of the things we are seeing. And it is, in a sense, politically neutral to the degree that you see it from both the right and the left. It is the cultural moment we are living in right now.
Danielle, you agree with that?
I think social media provides opportunities as well as challenges. Without any question, it's permitted people to coordinate who have views that are counterproductive, that don't respect the norms of civility. And I think there's been an erosion of our standards for what modes of engagement should require. So For example, it's, you know, I don't have to tell anybody, the norm on places like Facebook and Twitter is to start off with a snarky comment or an insulting comment or an ad hominem comment. And that is very corrosive of democratic discourse. I think in that regard, there's a lot of work that we all need to do to restore the basic idea that you respond to the idea. You respond to the idea in terms of other ideas, with evidence, with argument. Peter gave an argument, substantive one, mm-hmm. response to my op-ed. I would argue back to him, substantively speaking, that by the point in the campaign where I wrote this, the now president had not walked away from core substantive commitments, including mass deportations, threats to change libel laws with regard to the media, use of force against the families of terrorists, which is to say targeting of civilians, et cetera. There were a list of policy positions that were very much open and alive and on the table. We have not seen those specific things come to fruit, thank heavens, but they were open and alive on the table. So I think we were facing a moment where we genuinely had to make judgments about what prospect was in front of us, especially given that we were all judging a candidate who had no political experience and therefore no actions that we could use against which to calibrate his words.
But let me just say this. That's back on the argument that you were making.
Right, I'm
on
trying
that
to exemplify with Peter what it means to have a substantive
totally
conversation.
Fair I mean, this enough. Is absolutely well done. But what we're also talking about, right, is this larger culture, I guess, that we're in, where it is unacceptable to make those kinds of arguments, right, or to have the discussion in an intelligent and thoughtful way. What, Peter, do you believe that this tracks along, this intolerance for oppositional yeah. views and the reaction that they get tracks along with the rise of social media, which I think, yeah. Brian, you were saying there's a parallel to that.
There is a parallel. I agree with comments by Brian and Danielle about social media. But in my judgment, a far bigger cause of rising intolerance, especially among the intellectual class, has been a failure of our educational system. The educational system, and for longer than 10 or 15 years, has been failing to teach our students the principles of toleration, civility, and democratic discourse. If we were doing a better job of that, I think that our young men and women would be in a better position to conduct themselves on social media. Or put differently, I think we would be arming our young men and women, our students, to defend themselves better against the temptations presented by social media if we were teaching the principles of free speech on which the country is based.
Are you saying that students now young Americans don't learn how to think critically, or is it more than that?
It's more than that. Actually, I'm not even quite saying that, although
okay.
it's connected to it. There are a number of recent polls, including by Gallup, including work done by the Foundation of Individual Rights in Education, which is suggesting that our students have poor knowledge of the First Amendment and what it protects. And second, when they're informed, don't much like it. I could tell you about a recent book out, actually by two professors, both men of the left, Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the dean at Berkeley, and Howard Gilman, who I think is provost, University of California, Irvine, also professor of law and politics. And their book about free speech on campus actually begins from a seminar they co-taught in January 2016, I think, on free speech. And they report that their students, their freshmen, true freshmen, had a poor understanding of free speech. And when the professors explained it to them, they said, we don't really very much like the idea that offensive and harmful speech mm-hmm. is protected. To my mind, that's worrisome, that students arrive at the university without a knowledge of freedom of speech and a lack of knowledge about its contribution both to education and to free and democratic politics.
You're both based on campuses. Do you see this happening?
I think it's certainly the case that students are under-equipped to deal with controversial argumentation, and I would put a related point to Peter's somewhat differently. I think there are two things here. There is a right to free speech. Academic freedom is also very important. And they're not exactly the same things, mm-hmm. which causes a lot of confusion. But even more importantly, the right to free speech doesn't bring with it a right that nobody should be offended by what is said. And so I think our, in some sense, biggest problem is that we don't equip students to know how to deal with the experience of being offended and yet nonetheless to contribute productively. That is, you can take offense at something and not contribute to further offense and sort out the substance from the personal and address the substance.
Now I feel like we're getting to the core of the roundtable here, right? How did we get to a place, Brian, where we can not be tolerant of being offended and then know what to do about, you know, that sensation of being offended? Because that's important, too. What do you do about it? But first to the first point.
How did we get to this place? Well, first of all, I would agree that the level of knowledge of incoming students of things like the First Amendment is not particularly high. But I would not limit that either to the First Amendment or to incoming college students. That is, I think right. The level of literacy among Americans in general about the Constitution, about history, about geography, about a whole range of things is unfortunately and woefully low. And our students are not unique, but they're not immune from that low level of knowledge. So yes, our students don't come in with a deep understanding of the First Amendment, but neither do most Americans have a deep understanding of the First Amendment.
Why is that?
We have not done a very good job in this country of educating people through our K-12 system, if you want me to be totally honest. I think the American education system is not in a great state. And so students arrive at college not as prepared as we'd like them to be to engage in the kind of thinking and discourse that we'd like to take place in college. And I don't think that is a political issue. I think it's a qualitative issue that has to do with the American education system.
You agree with that, Peter?
I agree with every word, but I would also go farther.
Uh-huh.
The problem is not only ignorance. That's a very serious problem. But also our universities have been not just home to, but actually pushing doctrines for 40 or 50 years now that are really hostile to freedom of speech. One can go all the way back to the 1960s, Herbert Marcuse on repressive tolerance. One can go to certain postmodern doctrines. One can go to the teachings of Catherine MacKinnon, which were very popular when I was a law student in the late 1980s. All these doctrines teach that actually the institutions of free speech, the whole constellation of rights that the Constitution protects, these actually harbor universal, invisible, and pervasive discrimination, or promote it. And so we need to overcome these merely formal rights. That accompanies the ignorance.
I was reading a piece that you wrote for, I think it's Real Clear Politics in August, and you said campuses have become, quote, breeding grounds, training camps, and launching pads in the campaign to curtail liberty of thought and discussion. It is on our campuses where the battle for free speech will be won or lost.
Can I respond
to
that?
Yeah, please.
I think that's wrong. I think that as someone who spends his life and has spent his whole life on a college campus, it is certainly the case that instances of intolerance take place. I absolutely condemn the kinds of incidents that have taken place at places like Middlebury and at Evergreen State. I think that refusing to listen to someone at a commencement because you disagree with one thing they've done in their lives is outrageous. Having said that, I think that the examples that Peter cites, while true, are not representative. That is, I spend all of my time on a college campus, the vast majority of what I see is serious intellectual inquiry on the part of my faculty members and my students. I don't see indoctrination. The clearest evidence I have for that is that the views of our alumni are more diverse in every way, including politically, than the views of our incoming students. If we're indoctrinating, we're doing a pretty poor job of it.
Peter?
I congratulate the president of McAllister College and McAllister College for doing a terrific job then.
I think I hear you saying that they're the exception, not the rule to what you're talking about?
I suspect that they're the exception, not the rule. My experience or observation, I also have been not on university campuses for every second, but collecting paychecks from universities now for 30 years, have some experience for them. In my experience and my observation, there is a dominant perspective. The perspective is promulgated, especially in the humanities and the social sciences. Dissent is frowned upon. A good way to prevent dissenting opinions is to keep it off campus. It's often done so. You merely need to look. McAllister may be an exception, but if you look at the curricular offerings, empirical evidence of our leading colleges and universities, you'll find that they're one-sided. You will find that there's a significant dimension of the history, let's say, of American political thought that is respectable political thought that's simply not taught and goes unmentioned. And what's this got to do with freedom of thought? Formally, this is not free speech, but it contributes to an environment in which students are not exposed to the other side of the argument and thereby undermines their interest in free speech.
And Danielle, will you speak to that? I mean, we started the roundtable in talking about a situation that you were involved in where there was intolerance for an argument that you were making and you reaped the full reaction of that. Are college campuses, including the one that you teach at, partly to blame for this lack of being able to hear and respond to oppositional thought?
As with Brian, I have seen far more effort to defend freedom of speech and academic freedom than I have seen to undermine it. I will speak for myself and share only my own personal work and story. I teach, contra Peter's claim that nobody does, American political thought.
No,
I've been teaching the Declaration of Independence for years. Well, you did. You generalized. You said it's not taught.
So I said dimensions of American political thought that go untaught. Of course, the Declaration is taught. Sure.
I teach American political thought more broadly than the Declaration.
Terrific.
I think that we do need more ideological diversity on college campuses, but I don't think that the only voices saying that are coming from the right. I think there are voices on the left that are
Terrific.
Articulating that view as well. I do also think that, again, to repeat what Brian said, faculty members work very hard to teach students the skills of critical thinking. Harvard had a visit from Charles Murray, mm-hmm. undergraduates who disagree with his views, reached out to faculty members for conversations about what does this mean? What is this experience about? They spent time reading his work, picking it apart in terms of its arguments, preparing questions that were at the level of substance. They scheduled an event at, I can't remember if it's exactly the same time or a related time, to present alternative arguments to things that he was arguing for. This story is a story about teaching and about how you teach young people to engage with controversial arguments. I am not the only faculty member who participated in helping students think about this. Faculty members are doing this work, and it is inaccurate to say that we are not.
You're listening to the Friday Round, to you, Peter, in just a second. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation that's covered a lot of territory already, but at the core idea here is whether college campuses are still committed to the principle of the freedom of speech and how well students and faculty really understand what that means. Brian Rosenberg with us. He's the president of McAllister College, has been doing some writing on this. Peter Berkowitz is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and the author of Constitutional Conservatism. And Danielle Allen is a professor of government at Harvard and the author of a number of books, including Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. You wanted to respond, Peter.
Yes. First, I want to make clear, of course, colleges and universities teach American political thought. I meant to say, I hope I did say, dimensions are neglected. From my point of view, it's not enough for professors to say they're in favor of freedom of speech. It's not good enough for universities to pat themselves on the back for permitting Charles Murray to speak. Charles Murray speaking on a college campus ought to be a routine event. Charles Murray has written several important books that shed light, made controversial claims. There should be protest, fine, but disruption, not at all. Once again, one could go through course offerings in political science, let's say, or history at our leading colleges and universities, And one would find that there are dimensions, not just conservative thought, military history, diplomatic history, constitutional history. I recognize that Danielle is an expert in political theory and makes up for some of this lack. But generally and for the most part, there is a one-sidedness. And here's my point. The curricular one-sidedness contributes to the erosion of freedom of speech because it deprives students of the opportunity on a regular basis of encountering the other side of the political
matter. I understand that. Brian, is that true?
It is certainly true that curricula now and always are selective and faculty necessarily make choices. I think where I would dispute Peter's argument is because it seems to be based in the notion that 30 or 40 years ago we had a kind of unbiased curriculum that has now become biased. What we have to remember is that curricula have always excluded certain voices and perspectives. So that if you go back decades ago, I was a graduate student at Columbia, which has a very well-known core curriculum. When I was there as a graduate student at Columbia, their core humanities course had no women and no people of color represented on the curriculum. One of the things that's happened over the last decades is that college curricula have begun to include voices that were previously excluded. So the notion that we, in 1965 or 1955, had the right curriculum or an unbiased curriculum and have now moved toward a curriculum that's biased, I think, ignores the fact that there have been voices excluded in the past that are now included.
I'm sorry, but I think Brian has put words in my mouth. I never claimed that in 30 years ago in 1955, the curriculum was not biased. In fact, my opinion is that in the 1950s, of course it was biased, not only for the reasons that you mentioned, but because it was also biased in the ways that it is today. In any case, bias and problems in the past can hardly be a justification for maintaining biases in the present. I'll add this. As Danielle has pointed out, we live in a time of particular political polarization. It seems to me, if anything, the obligation on universities to be presenting aggressively both sides of the argument has never been greater.
So I agree with that. Again, I'll repeat my comment before that I think all campuses should be working on ideological diversity, particularly in their public programming and also in terms of the intellectual world that they're building. That said, this is where we get to the hard issue of the relationship between freedom of speech and academic freedom and the different kinds of judgments that you make under each category. So with regard to freedom of speech, yes, we all have a right to express our opinions, our views in the context of the public sphere of politics. The purpose of academic freedom is to protect the work of critical judgments about the quality of arguments. And the decisions that people make about when an argument is a good one and should be disseminated and distributed through publication or whatever other form, or a bad one and should not be disseminated. Now, if we take a very specific example of Charles Murray's bell curve, I'm sorry to use him as the example. That's it's a good concrete example that people can dig into. I read that book years ago, read it again this fall with students. There's a lot of fallacious argumentation in the book. I don't think it stands up on scholarly terms. Now, that's not a judgment about whether or not he should be brought to speak on campus about whatever he's working on now, but it is a judgment about whether that book should become, say, a basic part of a basic and standard
which
curriculum.
Which I sense you wouldn't disagree with.
Two replies. Once, when I was a young assistant professor, I was complaining to a senior faculty member, I won't mention his name, about the flaws, the incoherencies, the absence of any empirical evidence in a book by Catherine MacKinnon called Toward a Feminist Theory of the State. And he was on the committee that actually approved publication of the book, and he said to me, Peter, if we held all books at Harvard University Press to that standard, nothing would get published. I agree with Danielle about standards, but there's a tremendous double standard in applying this question of academic standards to various kinds of scholarship. Second, most of the people who were violently protesting Charles Murray don't know anything about the bell curve. He was denounced as a white nationalist for recent books that he's been written. He wasn't coming to campus to speak about the bell curve. So while I'm with Danielle, let us impose the most rigorous academic standards, but let's do it in a consistent way.
Brian, does Charles Murray have the right to speak at Middlebury College without being interrupted and shouted down, no matter what is now known about the scholarship of the bell curve?
So this, I think, gets to what I think is one of the key misunderstandings of this whole argument. Does mm-hmm. Charles Murray have the right to speak at Middlebury College? No. Middlebury College is a private institution. And very often in these public arguments, we confuse freedom of speech, and again, it gets to understanding what the First Amendment actually says, with quality of education. Does Charles Murray have the right to speak at Middlebury College? No.
Wish I'd used a different word, but
well,
okay.
But no, I'm glad you used that word, because I've been wanting to make this point. Is it better if Charles Murray comes to Middlebury College and is met with a respectful audience? Yes. Would it improve the quality of the education we provide to our students if they are exposed to a wide range of opinions? Yes. There is a real difference between some public institutions, Berkeley and others, where there is a legal requirement that anyone who wants to can rent space, and what goes on at a private institution. I think we all agree that it is the job of the university constantly to make qualitative judgments about speech, in effect, to curate. We do it as academics when we decide what gets published. We do it in our classes when we grade our students. We do it when we decide who comes in to speak. I suspect the physics department at Stanford would not welcome a speaker who wanted to come in and make the case that the earth is flat. And so for me, it's a question not of free speech, but of quality of speech. I think we should make judgments about quality, but I would agree that we should not filter out speech on the basis merely of its political perspective.
Yes, I think that's certainly right on the question of rights. And certainly, I certainly agree with the point about the necessity for universities to have standards and impose them. But I would add this in the case of Murray. Once the invitation was issued and accepted and the university agreed to host him, it was incumbent upon members of the university community not to violently disrupt the speech and shout it down.
I think we all agree with that. I think we're all on the same page on that. And I think that brings us back to the educational question again and how we educate young people to participate in hard conversations, including ones to which they have a reaction of feeling offended, mm-hmm. and nonetheless to be able to participate productively and creatively. I think there's an important thing to say about our educational system, which goes beyond what my two colleagues have said here. I disagree with the view that our educational system is failing. To the contrary, I think we're exceeding exceptionally well at what we've tried to do, which is to tilt our educational system in the direction of STEM education. And if you look at the results of our educational system, we are doing better with regard to STEM. But what we're seeing is a decline in relationship to the humanities and social sciences. And you can see that in terms of time spent on these subjects in K through 12 and in a variety of other ways. But it matters. There's a serious consequence to this. There's data available. People have been working in different ways for a while, but a new report from Circle, which is a research entity about civic learning and engagement mm-hmm. at Tufts in September, that correlates, it tracks the relationship between what students major in and whether they vote and participate. And there is a huge gap between, say, what engineers do with regard to political participation mm-hmm. and what people who major in humanities or education and social sciences.
And so connect this for us.
We have tilted our entire educational system in the direction of STEM. And because of how we teach STEM, we are undermining civic preparation. There's lots to be said about ways in which education in the humanities and social sciences itself needs reform. But nonetheless, it is the case that without that as a serious component of our educational system, we are not preparing people for civic readiness.
Which comes back to how do you behave in a...
It's about language skills.
As a citizen to yep. respond to arguments that you find intolerable.
It's about how do you dissect arguments, yes. So what sentence starters do you use to engage in a debate so that you can both affirm your respect for the humanity of the person with whom you're speaking while speaking to the substance of their argument. I mean, there are lots of things to be taught and learned that we're not teaching and learning.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation that asks whether college campuses are committed to the American ideal of freedom of speech, how this plays out day to day on college campuses, what are some of the other factors that influence how students think about this, what's happening with faculty, and this is the discussion that Americans are having in a larger sense. Danielle L. Allen is one of our guests. She's a professor of government at Harvard and author of a book that includes Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. Peter Berkowitz is here. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and the author of Constitutional Conservatism. Danielle and Peter were in town for a discussion on academic freedom at St. Olaf, and Brian Rosenberg, president of McAllister College. Brian, you wanted to pick up on what Danielle was saying about this tilt towards science and technology and why that has left students basically unprepared for civic engagement. Agree or no?
It's a great point, and I hadn't really thought fully about it. We are certainly seeing, not just at McAllister, but nationally, a strong movement, almost a tidal wave of movement toward the STEM disciplines among students. We've gone from about 20% of our students having a STEM major to 50% of our students at a liberal arts college. And I think it does reflect a whole variety of ways in which the humanities and the social sciences have been devalued in our educational system. And it probably does connect to some of the failures of discourse that we're seeing. The only qualifier that I would add is that I do think we are doing a good job on STEM education with the kinds of students who get admitted to places like Stanford and Harvard and McAllister. I think there is a huge gap between how well we're doing on STEM education between students in certain socioeconomic brackets and students who are in lesser brackets. In the Twin Cities, as we all know, there's a huge race-based achievement gap, and we're not doing so well on STEM in the public schools of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Danielle, I have a question. Here's what I don't understand about the argument. Science, understanding science means really learning how to understand how to think critically in the face of evidence that might be pointing you in a different way. Now, I know this is not specifically civic education, but don't you learn the very skills that we're suggesting that too many Americans don't have?
I think we could probably redesign STEM education to support that, and certainly STEM's work on reasoning is very valuable. It is, however, extremely quantitative, and the work of being a citizen is verbal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem.
This is what you were saying about how do you hear the argument and know
Absolutely.
Okay.
And how do you have the verbal agility to separate the ad hominem parts from the substantive parts and address the substantive parts.
And you're not getting that in a curriculum that is just too focused on
Correct.
Science and
As
tech.
As we currently teach STEM, students are not getting that verbal education.
Peter?
And I agree with Danielle, and there's a good reason for this. In On Liberty, John Stuart Mill makes an excellent observation. He says, in mathematics, arithmetic, there's nothing to be said on the other side of the question. We don't have time for those who insist that 2 plus 2 equals 5. Whereas in moral and political matters, he says, it's almost always the case that if it's worth talking about, there's something to be said, maybe truth mixed with falsehood, on the other side of the question. So when we are engaged in study of humanities, history, literature, philosophy, political principles, when it's taught correctly, we are irresistibly drawn in, when it's done correctly, irresistibly drawn into a world when we're constantly forced to appreciate both weaknesses and the views to which we're inclined and strengths and the views to which we're not inclined. Now, having all said all that, we also have to look inside, look at ourselves, as we're all three of us in the educational world. Harvard commissioned a study 6-7 years ago, I'm not sure, of its humanities program. The humanities professors conducted the study. Why? Because they began from this observation. 50% of the students who were matriculating at Harvard with the intention of studying the humanities dropped out of the humanities after the first year. They moved on to the social sciences or somewhere else. Yes, there's been a focus on STEM, but also the Harvard study suggests, the Harvard professors themselves came to the conclusion, we, the professors of the humanities, were not effectively teaching the humanities. We need to improve our teaching of
what is that? Is that relevance to? Is that a question of relevance?
My own view is that we need to maybe not go back to the good old days, but create good new days by depoliticizing the study of the humanities, by removing some of the impenetrable jargon, and once again giving students an encounter with a wide variety of works of literature, works of history, works of politics.
The relevance, how does my life experience fit with what I'm learning? Or
I would not put that question first, but because that invites students to think this is all about themselves and to focus on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But in any humanities class worth anything, students will inevitably discover in the course of wrestling with texts and in the course of wrestling with fellow students' opinions about the text, the students will discover invaluable observations and insights about themselves if they don't put themselves first, if they put the study of the ideas and texts first.
Can I ask you, this is a little more specific and practical, I guess, than the discussion we've been having, but I think it would be valuable to hear from you on what a tolerant and thoughtful argument sounds like when you, to do exactly what Danielle kind of described, take the substance of the argument, know how to respond to that, and have one of these elevated discussions where you walk away saying, I was heard, they were heard, we're better for it.
I don't think it's magical. I do think in this particular time,
okay,
we do need to pay attention in the classroom to how we teach certain habits of mind and maybe even habits of character in addition to content. I don't get into the classroom a lot any longer, unfortunately, but a couple of years ago, I team taught with a political scientist a class for first-year students on civic ideals in American higher education. We deliberately chose the most controversial topics we could, and we staged formal debates, and we told students which viewpoint they had to argue for. So, for instance, we talked about affirmative action, and they didn't get to choose which side they argued for on the basis of their own beliefs. They were assigned a side. And what that teaches them is how to construct an argument, how to put yourself into the mind of someone with whom you do not necessarily agree. I am, as I think you know, a big believer in the essential importance of empathy.
Uh-huh.
And it was quite successful. This class was consistently civil. Some of them actually changed their mind by inhabiting a different viewpoint. They were all forced to look at evidence. They were all forced to have their views tested. I think that simple, pretty old-fashioned structure can be a really effective way of helping students think about not just the subject of a class, but how to think and how to encounter and how to respond to an argument.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking that's exactly what, and this brings us back to the beginning with social media, having your argument tested is exactly what does not happen.
Mm-hmm.
On social media, you vomit it out and somebody responds, right? Isn't this right, Peter?
Alas, it's right. The movement of the conversation reminds me of something I heard when I was a law student from a visiting professor, Chief Justice of a Supreme Court, not in the United States. He was also a professor, and he said, my job as a judge, I confront problems. My job is to find the solutions. But the job of your professors, law school, is to take my solutions and find the problems. I'm delighted by what Danielle says about her classrooms and Brian says about his classrooms. What we can do in our classrooms, which doesn't happen right on social media, is to every proposition about a text, about an idea, about an event, about a claim, it seems to me our job, we who lead the conversation, or those who lead conversations mm-hmm. on the radio, is to bring out what's questionable, what's problematic, what's ambiguous in a point of view. Then you get another answer, time for another question. Now, this seems to me doesn't leave us nowhere, because even if every position at the end of the day is still subject to more questions, by this kind of discussion, conversation, even vigorous debate, one can develop a sense of what is the stronger position, the worthier position.
The other thing that I've noticed, and maybe you three have as well, that there is a lack of relish in having your argument tested. There's an impatience with just, I want to be able to blurt it out. I want to see what the reaction is. And I don't really care whether what I've said at the test is right or not. And I don't want to have my mind changed.
Yes, there is a lack of relish. And if you allow me one more story. My most memorable moment as an undergraduate at Swarthmore College was on the last day of class with a professor who was asked the standard question, "Professor, what are you expecting on the final exam?" And his memorable answer was, "I'll tell you. On your first hour exam, I admired the precision and eloquence with which you restated my views. On your second hour exam, I found myself growing bored with your answers, despite the fact that they were still eloquent and precise renditions of my own view. And if on your final exam, all you do is restate my views, well, I don't care how precisely and eloquently it is. There's no telling how badly I may react." That's right. The relish, and right. That's what we need to encourage.
I mean, I guess, Brian, what I'm saying that is there seems to be and again, this brings us back to how we started with Danielle's experience with this, a malevolence and such a deep anger around what could be the exchange of ideas that I think we should relish.
That's what college campuses are so important.
Go ahead. Yes.
And again, I really believe that I don't consider what I did exceptional. I don't consider myself an exceptional teacher. I think there are teachers at McAllister who are far more gifted than I am who are doing that kind of inquiry every day. There are examples of bad actors. There are examples both among students and faculty. It's always been the case. I think where we, at the end of the day, are just going to have to differ is whether that is the norm or the exception. I think in most classrooms at most universities and colleges, students and faculty are engaging in this kind of discourse and this kind of intellectual inquiry. Those are not the classrooms that attract attention. The moments that attract attention are the Charles Murray moments, unfortunately.
Danielle, we started with your experience with this, writing an op-ed that got a lot of attention and a lot of unwanted and intolerant attention. Can I ask you whether if there's a moment of self-censorship, I guess, for lack of a better word, if you hesitate to write the way you wrote, having gone through this?
That's a hard question to answer in a short way. I continue to write. I continue to believe it's my job to do my best to try to discern the truth and to try to articulate that. I continue to try to be careful of my formulations. I was trying even then. People would say I failed, and I can certainly understand that criticism, though I certainly believe in that effort and continue to make it. I think, what am I trying to say?
Well, I mean, it does sound like the answer is no, but
I don't think I can answer the question, in all honesty. I don't think I can answer it. I worry about my children in a way that I didn't previously. I can't answer your question.
I mean, that's not what we would want, for you to ever hesitate to make the kind of arguments that you feel you have to make, right?
I do my best to keep making them.
Thank you all for a good discussion. Thanks
You're
for being
welcome.
Here.
Thank you.